This is one of the most important videos we can watch, digest, and share on the potential brink of a world war to understand what is actually going on. So stick around to the end and use the chapters below to stay with me. Here's exactly what's going on in one sentence: an orchestrated, systematic destruction of the society, the financial system, governments, and the world as we've known it at large by globalists, a part of the World Economic Forum, and the international cult of private central banks to usher in a new global centralized authority, bank, and system of control. Everything that's going on, none of it's about morals, values, democracy, ideologies, climate change, allies, enemies, political parties. It's not about any of those distractions. It's all about a mission by globalists and private central banks to consolidate power, control, and money. And to accomplish this mission, they have to take our money, they have to take our freedom, they have to take our lives. And the most efficient way to do this is to destroy everything. Destroy social order, destroy decentralized banking, destroy our currency, destroy our culture, destroy our relationships with each other, other countries. Just basically divide and destroy until there's nothing left. Nothing left except the new system of control where they completely control every aspect of every human being's lives. Where if they are successful, we will own nothing. No homes, no land, no cars, no property, no businesses. We don't even own the money that we earn. And although some of our knee-jerk reactions to this may be, calm down, conspiracy theorists, that's absurd, the reality is they're not even hiding it. They're out here telling us all about it in plain sight. In fact, they've been telling us for years, writing and distributing articles about it, posting videos about it. Check out this video they produced and posted on the World Economic Forum's social media accounts all the way back in 2016. 8 predictions for the world in 2030. You'll own nothing and you'll be happy. Whatever you want, you'll rent, and it'll be delivered by drone. 2. The US won't be the world's leading superpower. A handful of countries will dominate. You won't die waiting for an organ donor. We won't transplant organs. We'll print new ones instead. I wonder how much the rent will be on those organs. 4. You'll eat much less meat. An occasional treat, not a staple. For the good of our environment and our health. 5. A billion people will be displaced by climate change. We'll have to do a better job at welcoming and integrating refugees. 6. Polluters will have to pay to emit carbon dioxide. There will be a global price on carbon. This will help make fossil fuels history. 7. You could be preparing to go to Mars. Scientists will have worked out how to keep you healthy in space. The start of a journey to find alien life? Well, they already rushed that one. I guess they're here, right? 8. Western values will have been tested to the breaking point. Checks and balances that underpin our democracies must not be forgotten. This is their playbook. This is their blueprint. Who created this? The World Economic Forum. Who's in charge of it? Klaus Schwab is the chairman. Check this guy out at the 2022 World Government Summit.
History is truly at a turning point. We do not yet know the full extent and the systemic and structural changes which will happen. However, we do know that global energy systems, food systems, and supply chains will be deeply affected. In times of crisis, the role of governments is more important and more relevant than ever. What is also needed is a summit like this one to go beyond crisis management and to look into constructive ways we can build our common future.
Is that not a scene of a villain from a dystopian movie? Yes, well, Klaus is calling their plan the Great Reset, which he wrote a book about called COVID-19, The Great Reset. And in it, he writes, every country from the United States to China must participate, and every industry from oil and gas to tech must be transformed. In short, we need a great reset of capitalism. Ominous, right? To lighten things up, I found an interesting interpretation of Klaus's vision for us and the new world. Check it out.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to hear it in your pod. You'll own nothing and be happy. Ain't got no cash, ain't got no car, but 24 booster shots in your arm. Own nothing, be happy. You can't even buy shit in the store because of your low social credit score. Own nothing, be happy. You'll own nothing and be happy. Be happy and eat the bugs.
Eat the bugs. Pizza bugs is actually another thing they are blatantly out here trying to sell us. Here's an article they posted on their website from February 2022. 5 reasons why eating insects could reduce climate change. Man, you would think they would make a little more of an effort to find at least a more appetizing looking bug for this headline. And I was just going to share the headline of this article, but the 5 reasons are pure gold. 1. Edible insects can produce equivalent amounts of quality protein when compared to animals. One easy way of integrating insect protein into your diet would be through cricket protein powder, used in place of your typical protein supplement powder. Wow, how awesome is that? 2. Insects require less care and upkeep than livestock. I'll give them that. That makes sense. 3. We're actually running out of protein. I don't know. I honestly have no idea. 4. Insects are part of a virtuous eco-cycle. Oh really, then why should we eat them? Isn't it more virtuous to let them keep contributing to this virtuous eco-cycle than preventing them by, you know, eating them? Oh, and here's the banger for anyone who still has some reservations about being virtuous and helping reduce climate change by eating insects. 5. You can start small and work your way up. Maybe you're not quite ready to eat an insect. Fair enough. But there are small and meaningful ways to introduce insect proteins into your food chain. How about incorporating it as livestock feed or purchasing animals' proteins that have fed on insects? Did you know a chicken's natural diet before domestication included insects? Switching to pet food that contains insect protein is an important way you can make a real impact on the environment. Dogs and cats currently consume 1/4 of the meat that is produced in the US. Very logic, much smart. Chicken's natural diet includes insects. Why can't ours? Hey, a small step in the right direction is by feeding insects to our dogs and our cats. Kella, do you want to eat insects? Does that sound good to you? She says no. She doesn't. What about you, Lyra? Would you like to eat some insects? She also says no. Who are these people? How about the number 2 guy at the World Economic Forum? What's the number 2 guy out here saying?
Humans are now hackable animals. You know, the whole idea that humans have, you know, this, they have this soul or spirit and they have free will and nobody knows what's happening inside me. So whatever I choose, whether in the election or whether in the supermarket, this is my free will, that's over. Free will, that's over. Now, in the past, many tyrants and governments wanted to do it, but nobody understood biology well enough to hack millions of people. But soon, at least some corporations and governments will be able to systematically hack all the people.
I have no words. Hello, I'm Crypto Casey, and in this video, we are going to explore a timeline of events from an article called All Wars Are Bankers' Wars by Michael Rivero that have led up to what is happening now, the orchestrated, systematic destruction of the world as we know it by globalists and private central banks, and what we can do to rise like phoenixes from the ashes to forge a new, better world together. Let's hit it. Be sure to check out our sponsors, Afani, Heatbit, and Tangem Wallet. Get 100% guaranteed protection against SIM swapping using Afani's secure cellular services, which you can learn more about in this video. Easily mine Bitcoin for passive income with Heatbit Mini's easy-to-use 3-in-1 Bitcoin mining rig, which is also both a space heater and air purifier. And invest in your very own cold storage hardware wallet like Tangem Wallet. It's the size of a credit card, multi-chain, multi-currency, and it's by far the easiest crypto wallet to set up and use on the market right now. So scroll down and use the links below to access the correct and official sites, as well as redeem any special offers they have for us. Sweet. Here's a simple, important thing to understand. Private central banks like the Federal Reserve have been starting wars to force their banking systems onto other nations for centuries. So we will start the timeline of events to prove this notion with the American Revolution. The American Revolution was primarily inspired by King George III's Currency Act, which forced colonists to conduct business using only printed banknotes borrowed from the Bank of England at a costly interest rate. And what most people don't know is that the colonies had created their own money, called the colonial scrip, and it was interest-free, wealth-based money issued by the colonies themselves. And here's a famous quote from Benjamin Franklin describing how it worked. That is simple. In the colonies, we issue our own money. It is called colonial scrip. We issue it in proper proportion to the demands of trade and industry to make the products pass easily from the producers to the consumers. In this manner, creating for ourselves our own paper money, We control its purchasing power, and we have no interest to pay. And it worked great from when it was created in 1750 to around 1764, until the Bank of England, a private central bank, and their bought and paid for king made it illegal. And here's another quote from Benjamin Franklin following the Currency Act. The colonies would gladly have borne the little tax on tea and other matters had it not been that England took away from the colonies their money, which created unemployment and dissatisfaction. The inability of colonists to get power to issue their own money permanently out of the hands of George III and the international bankers was the prime reason for the Revolutionary War. Nice. So, after the Revolutionary War, the US government actually took steps to try to prevent another private central bank from interfering with the new government. Here's an important telling quote from Thomas Jefferson, basically predicting our current situation hundreds of years beforehand. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs. And here's another quote by John Adams in a letter to Thomas Jefferson. All the perplexities, confusion, and distresses in America arise not from defects in the Constitution or Confederation, nor from the want of honor or virtue, as much from downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. And this is why I started making videos to try and spread awareness about how the current traditional financial system works and alternatives we can explore to try and build a better world together, like blockchain-based financial systems. I mean, here is a quote directly from the governor of the Bank of England, Montagu Norman, addressing the United States Bank years ago with the same exact blueprint and game plan the current private central bankers are using today. Check it out. Capital must protect itself in every possible way, both by combination and legislation. Debts must be collected, mortgages foreclosed as rapidly as possible. When, through process of law, the common people lose their homes, they will become more docile and more easily governed through the strong arm of the government applied by a central power of wealth under leading financiers. These truths are well known among our principal men, who are now engaged in forming an imperialism to govern the world. By dividing the voter through the political party system, we can get them to expend their energies in fighting for questions of no importance. It is thus, by discreet action, we can secure for ourselves that which has been so well planned and so successfully accomplished. History is not only rhyming, it is nearly repeating itself. So how is it that the United States was founded with the intention of keeping private central bankers out of the government, yet we are back to where we started? Well, it's very simple. Bankers are dedicated to schemes of acquiring our wealth and know how easy it is to corrupt nations' leaders. Mayor Amschel Rothschild said this famous quote, "Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who makes the laws." And just 1 year later, he and his chief supporter, Alexander Hamilton, were successful in setting up a new private central bank called the First Bank of the United States. It was founded in 1791, and by the end of its 20-year charter, the United States was in ruins, all while the bankers flourished. So when Congress refused to renew the charter with the intention of going back to a state-issued, value-based currency where the people paid no interest at all to any banker, the head of the private central bank, Nathan Mayer Rothschild, threatened the U.S. government with a war. And when Congress held their position to not renew the charter, Rothschild tried to force Spencer Percival, the British Prime Minister at the time, to start a war with the U.S. to take the colonies back. And when he refused, he was assassinated, the only British Prime Minister to be assassinated in office. His replacement, Robert Banks Jenkins, was fully supportive of a war, and Rothschild financed it at virtually no interest. It was the War of 1812, and the intention was to recolonize the U.S. or put the U.S. into so much debt that they would be forced to accept a new private central bank, which is what ended up happening. Even though the U.S. won the war, Congress was forced to grant a new charter for another private central bank that issued public currency and loans with interest, and it was called the Second Bank of the United States. This private central bank brought the U.S. back into ruins yet again with tons of debt, unemployment, and poverty, until Andrew Jackson came along, campaigning for president with the slogan, "Jackson and no bank." He became president and blocked the renewal of the charter for the Second Bank of the United States with this famous quote. "Gentlemen, I too have been a close observer of the doings of the Bank of the United States. I have had men watching you for a long time and am convinced that you have used the funds of the bank to speculate in the breadstuffs of the country. When you won, you divided the profits amongst you. And when you lost, you charged it to the bank. You tell me that if I take the deposits from the bank and annul its charter, I shall ruin 10,000 families? That may be true, gentlemen, but that is your sin. Should I let you go on, you will ruin 50,000 families. And that would be my sin. You are a den of vipers and thieves. I have determined to rout you out, and by the eternal, I will rout you out. And he did, and he also routed out all of the national debt. Andrew Jackson was the only American president to actually pay off the national debt. And oddly enough, an assassination attempt was made on him, where fortunately for him, both pistols the attacker was wielding failed to fire. So when the Second Bank of the United States lost its charter, it continued to operate as a regular bank and failed after about 5 years. After Andrew Jackson, President Zachary Taylor came into office and he opposed the creation of a new private central bank, stating, "The idea of a national bank is dead and will not be revived in my time." And then, oddly enough, he died after eating a bowl of cherries and milk, rumored to have been poisoned with arsenic. Next, President James Buchanan was in. He also opposed a private central bank, set limits on banks issuing more loans than they had actual funds, and he was also poisoned with arsenic. But he survived, while the other 38 people at dinner died. Crazy. Which brings us to the next war started by bankers, the Civil War. That's right, when the Confederacy seceded from the United States, private central banks offered to fund President Abraham Lincoln's efforts to bring the South back into the Union at 30% interest. Lincoln responded by saying he would not free slaves by enslaving people to the bankers, and used his presidential authority to issue a new government interest-free currency called the greenback. And so the bankers retaliated by sending a letter to every bank in the U.S. urging them to fund the mainstream media at the time, newspapers, to oppose Lincoln's greenbacks. A quote from Lincoln says, "I have two great enemies, the Southern Army in the front of me, and the bankers in the rear. Of the two, the one at my rear is my greatest foe." The bankers also urged Europe to support the Confederacy to defeat Lincoln's Union, where France and Britain were really considering attacking the United States to help the Confederacy. But Russia actually prevented them. Tsar Alexander II had just ended serfdom and had a state bank similar to the one the U.S. was originally founded on. He authorized Russian aid to Lincoln, and, like the recurring pattern goes, multiple assassination attempts were made on him in 1866, 1879, and 1880, until a successful one was made in 1881. And after the Union won the war, Lincoln announced that he would continue issuing greenbacks, and then he was assassinated. After he was killed, greenbacks were pulled from circulation, and the U.S. was forced to go back to private central bank notes with interest. Next up, we have President James Garfield, who was elected in 1880, who was in support of government-controlled money, and he was shot in 1881 and died a few days later. Then, in 1896, President William McKinley was elected and favored gold-backed currencies. He was shot in 1901 and died a few days later. Which brings us to 1910, when six of America's richest men had a secret meeting organized by J.P. Morgan and held on his private property on Jekyll Island, where the idea for the United States' third private central bank was born. There's a conspiracy that there were three men that stood in J.P. Morgan's way of creating it: John Astor, Isidore Strauss, and Benjamin Guggenheim. That all happened to be on J.P. Morgan's boat, the Titanic, when it sank. Did big private central bankers sink the boat on purpose and get an insurance payout after it? Well, yes, J.P. Morgan got paid by the insurance company when his boat sank. Let me know what you think happened to the Titanic in the comments below. Either way, it sank in 1912, and 1 year later, the Third Bank of the United States was created over the Christmas holiday in 1913, while Congress members who opposed it were at home. And the bankers promised President Woodrow Wilson generous campaign contributions if he signed the act, which he did. And they decided to name it the Federal Reserve, to seem like a quasi-governmental entity when it actually is not a government entity at all. It is a private central bank. Here's a video of former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, explaining how it's a private entity that doesn't answer to any government authority.
What is the proper relationship? What should be the proper relationship between a chairman of the Fed and a president of the United States?
Well, first of all, the Federal Reserve is an independent agency, and that means basically that there is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take. So long as that is in place and there is no evidence that the administration or the Congress or anybody else is requesting that we do things other than what we think is the appropriate thing, then what the relationships are don't frankly matter. And I've had a very good relation.
Another fun fact is that the Federal Reserve is exempt from all taxation except property tax. Brilliant. A few years later, in 1919, Woodrow Wilson said, "I am a most unhappy man. I have unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is now controlled by its system of credit. We are no longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by conviction in the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men." Lame. Moving right along, we have the First World War. Note that before the creation of the Federal Reserve, there was no such thing as a world war. So although the war started between Austria-Hungary and Serbia with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, media focus was quickly shifted to Germany, a big economic threat to Great Britain. Following the Treaty of Versailles, Germany was forced to pay the war costs, even though they didn't even start the war, to their own private central bank, which they had gone into massive debt to pay for the war. Massive inflation followed, and the Germans were trapped in endless debt to the private central bank. So when Hitler came into power, his first financial move was what we've seen already throughout history, shifting to their own state-issued value-based currency, where they did not have to borrow from private central banks at interest. Germany's economy quickly started turning around and flourishing, and media called it the German miracle. So once again, Germany becomes a threat to Great Britain, and their state-issued monetary system was also a threat to private central banks. So they looked for an excuse to go to war, and obviously Hitler gave it to them. Towards the end of World War II, in 1944, the world's major economic powers met at a luxury resort in New Hampshire called Bretton Woods, where they created the Bretton Woods Agreement for international finance. This caused the British pound to lose its status as the world's reserve currency to the US dollar, and forced other nations to tie their currencies to the US dollar under two conditions. One, the Federal Reserve would not overprint US dollars as a means to steal goods and services from other countries in exchange for a devaluing currency, like an imperial tax. And two, the US dollar would always be convertible to gold at $35 per ounce. And obviously, both of those conditions were never kept, because the Federal Reserve is a private central bank that doesn't have to answer to the US government or other governing bodies. Amazing. Next, we've got President John F. Kennedy. He understood the private central bank's agenda and wrote and signed Executive Order 11110 that ordered the US Treasury to issue a new government-backed currency called the United States Note. They were created by the US government, backed by the silver stockpiles held by the US government. About $4.5 billion went into public circulation, and 5 months later, Kennedy was assassinated, and all the United States notes were pulled from circulation and destroyed. And it's important to note that Kennedy's Executive Order 11110 is actually still in effect. However, no president has been brave enough to touch it since. Great. Eventually, other countries started noticing the large piles of US dollars they were accumulating in exchange for real goods and services, like in the case of France, wine and cheese. They started exercising their option under the Bretton Woods Agreement to exchange the paper notes for gold. And since the Federal Reserve was overprinting money, the US government didn't have enough gold to redeem all the requests. And by 1966, an estimated $14 billion was held by foreign banks, while the US only had about $3.2 billion worth of gold. So President Richard Nixon had to temporarily suspend the convertibility of US dollars to gold, which obviously became permanent and ultimately ended the Bretton Woods Agreement. And side note, interestingly enough, this happened in 1971, which is the same year that the World Economic Forum was founded. It was initially called the European Management Forum, with the goal of introducing European business to American management practices. Sheer coincidence? Or orchestrated by private central bankers looking to consolidate power? Let me know what you think in the comments below. So once it became obvious that the US didn't have enough gold reserves to back its currency, faith in the United States' ability to pay off its debt decreased. To combat this, Richard Nixon started the environmental movement with the EPA, which effectively allowed the government to use public lands as collateral on national debt, under the guise that it was being protected and kept pristine. So eventually, about 25% of United States land had been seized by the government and pledged to foreign countries as collateral. With land in short supply, the US government made deals with the world's largest oil-producing countries, where in exchange for only selling their oil for US dollars, the US would guarantee military protection for them. And this is when the petrodollar system was born. So the US started effectively backing the US dollar with oil, other foreign countries' oil. Remarkable, isn't it? It's no wonder when Iraq, after the Desert Storm conflict, wanted their rights to sell oil in euros instead of the US dollar in the early 2000s, that the US reinvaded Iraq under the guise that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons he was going to use, when in reality, they did it just to get Iraq's oil transactions back to the US dollar. And when Libya announced they were only going to sell their oil for their state-owned value-based trade currency, the gold dinar, the US invaded Libya, killed their leader, imposed a private central bank, and put Libya's oil back on the market for US dollars only. And some of the Hillary Clinton emails released confirmed that the real reason the US invaded Libya was to counteract the threat of the gold dinar becoming a rival to the US dollar and petrodollar system. So what can we glean from history to piece together what may actually be going on and who stands to benefit from both the process and the outcome? Well, as the cycle goes, private banks issue currencies with interest, which forces countries and their people into more and more debt. Once the people and government stop borrowing, wars are waged that force everyone into more debt to pay for the wars. After that, countries and people need to borrow to rebuild. And when it's all said and done, everything is about the same except for more dead people, and the process repeats. So in the current situation, World War III would be an attempt to force the world onto a private central bank US dollar digital currency that is controlled by private central powers like the World Economic Forum, where they can dictate what we can and what we cannot buy, the amounts of goods we can buy, and if we can buy anything at all. And if you want to learn more about central bank digital currencies and why they are so dangerous to our livelihoods, check out this video guide by clicking on the link above. So is there hope for us? Do we stand a chance at rebuilding a better world together from the ashes of a more than likely extremely destructive world war? It's possible. Things are much different now with the internet, access to information, independent journalism, people becoming curious, looking for answers, and spreading awareness. So what can we do? We can be aware. Talk about it with our friends, family, and other people to spread awareness. Share content like this online. Educate as many people as possible. And we need to be prepared to weather the coming storm of capital controls, where countries start to restrict the money from flowing out of their countries so they can continue using their private central bank currencies to enslave and control people. It will probably become harder to convert fiat into hard assets like gold, Bitcoin, and similar. So it's more important than ever to understand how and why Bitcoin and blockchain technology offers a better alternative solution to private central banks. Something not controlled by a single person, business, government, authority, or entity. Rather by the very essence of our universe, with mathematics, physics, and science. And when we do choose to invest in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, it's important to understand that we do not actually own or control it until we transfer it from exchanges to our very own cold storage hardware wallets. Tangent Wallet is the most affordable, easy to use cold storage hardware wallet for beginners and experts alike that looks like a credit card, has the same level of protection used in passports and NASA. Its source code is open and available to review on GitHub, which is important for full transparency to ensure there are no backdoors built in, and that funds can be accessed if the company shut down for any reason. Note the pricing for this cryptocurrency hardware device is much cheaper and more affordable than other ones with free shipping. This is a plus for any beginners just getting started or anyone who is looking to onboard friends and families into crypto with a simple, easy-to-use, secure self-custody wallet. My friends and family love it, so scroll down and use link below to access the correct and official site, as well as redeem any special offers they have for us. Awesome. If you would like to watch a full video guide about Tangent Wallet and how it works, check out this video. If you would like to finally have that eureka moment about how Bitcoin works and how it can help us maintain complete control over some of our wealth, check out this video. And to get your very own Tangent Wallet, click on the link on the screen. Like and subscribe for more. Be safe out there.